So, let's do it.
Okay. Hi there, I'm Simon Mercip, and welcome to Crave. This is the podcast, the video cast, which usually deals with all manner of things entertainment. I say usually, because this week, Steve McCabe, we kind of have a heavier, weightier matter to discuss.
Well, you've kind of got your journalistic head on a little bit. I mean, it's fair enough. So we got some heavy stuff. We're going to be looking at one of the seamy side of somebody who was possibly the most influential and popular musician and entertainer in the world in his day.
Absolutely. I think that's incontrovertible, probably. Yeah. Of course, we're talking about Michael Jackson. This is this 4-hour documentary called Leaving Neverland, in which two men describe how they were, as boys, sexually abused by Jackson, and how they and their families were groomed by him.
Oh, yeah, very, very much so.
So, that's a heavy start, but...
That could be heavy. So we're going to lighten the load a little after that. We'll switch to some concerts. We've got the Red Hot Chili Peppers to talk about. There's a lot to talk about there.
Yes.
And then we'll go all Canadian for a second and do Bryan Adams. And why not?
And why not? We'll finish with... a question, does this latest Marvel movie called Captain Marvel, does it fulfill and sustain the overall quality of those which came before it?
Is it marvelous?
That's the question.
That's the question you set yourself up for, really, isn't it? When you give a film a name like that. So let's start off, shall we?
Yeah, yeah.
Leaving Neverland.
Mm.
So this is a 4-hour documentary. It's been broadcast in two parts. I think it was made by HBO in the US, and it's being shown by, is it TVNZ here?
Yes. Yep.
And it's forensic in its analysis.
Yes.
I mean, it's worth mentioning. I mean, what we can't do here, this is not a legal affairs podcast. We're not going to attempt to actually convict or acquit Jackson.
No.
Partly because he's dead and he can't defend himself.
Correct.
But what we can talk about is the production of the
yes, we can.
Of the doco, right?
Yeah. Yep, yep, yep. I managed to watch the whole thing over the week, which wasn't an easy thing to do. It was quite...
Well, it's 4 hours for a start. Yeah. So that alone is an ordeal.
It is a grueling watch.
Yes, it is.
It is sickeningly compelling.
Oh, okay.
If you can put those two words together. Because you're having these two men's accounts, Wade Robson, the lad who was born in Australia, and then James Safechuck, how they were ensnared by their account, by Michael Jackson, brought into his fold, and their families, and their mothers particularly.
Oh, yes.
And as you say, Steve, in some detail, documentary maker, Dan Reed, a Brit, by the way, takes you through step by step the entrapment, the grooming, the actual abuse, and the aftermath.
Yes.
Now, I think perhaps you didn't quite get to the end.
I've not got that far yet. I've not had a chance to watch the whole thing.
At the end, you have, in many ways, which is as awful as that telling of the detail is, you get to an account of how they eventually, these two young men who kept the secret inside themselves for decades, got to tell it.
Right.
And the effects on their families of that information.
Right.
And that really, I think, takes the documentary, it's obviously Jackson's at the center of it, but puts it into a slightly broader context of any sexual abuse victim. It's not just about them.
No.
It's awful. It's awful for them.
Yeah.
But when the family finds out, it's awful for everyone.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to take exception to what you said about Jackson's at the centre of it.
Yeah.
Because the structure of the whole thing, I think, is very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely... deadpan's the wrong word, isn't it? But it's very, very understated.
Yes.
It's mostly Safechuck and Robson talking to camera.
Yes.
With relevant video and photos intercut. So, I mean, I wondered in the past, for example, how did these boys come into Jackson's orbit?
Mm-hmm.
And so it actually reveals the stories. And as far as, I mean, we're going back to the 80s here, when not everyone was videoing everything.
Yes.
But you've got video of these boys when they are first entering his orbit. And so it's done very, very matter-of-factly. You've got these two young men who are talking directly to camera and very, very calmly narrating. Except for, I think, in the hour I've seen so far, once briefly you hear a voice prompting a question.
Yes, yeah.
Other than that, it's simply, this is what happened to me next.
Yeah.
And then he did this.
Yeah.
And then he did that. And it's completely dispassionate. It is clinical in its dissection of what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And fascinating to watch.
Yeah. I just to get back to what you said there, Steve, when I said centre, I mean, Jackson is the central, for want of a better word, villain in this story.
Okay, okay. Yeah.
But in the telling of this story,
yeah,
other sexual abuse victims could look at that and see patterns.
I would imagine they probably could, and learn
something from it potentially. That's what I mean. Look, you're right about the telling of it. It's quite slow and deliberate.
Yes.
The pace is quite slow. I felt that was obviously a deliberate way of allowing the audience time to absorb the information.
And there's a lot. It's meticulous.
Yeah. I mean, at one point, James takes you almost like on a tour of Neverland, all the rooms where the abuse took place, and there are photos and videos of each room. You're right, meticulous is the word. And I noticed journalistically, one little thing that struck me a couple of times, where obviously Dan Reed, the filmmaker, decided on one or two points, potentially contentious points, he wasn't sure. So at one point in, I think it's Wade's story, the issue of arises, who first said, come and sleep with me? Who initiated that? And he danced around it by having the mother make a comment of, well, I don't know who exactly it was, but they did sleep together. Yes. It was done in a roundabout way,
right,
just to cover the fact that he probably didn't know and couldn't prove it. I mean, they can't prove it now, but I just thought it was an interesting little illustration that I'm sure that Dan Reed was pretty rigorous as he could be in putting this together, and lawyers must have gone over it with a fine tooth comb.
There must have been a lot of very, very careful.
But nevertheless, the damage to Jackson's reputation is immense.
But what gets me is that he's still got a reputation. We've known this for a long time.
I would say that. That's very interesting. I think many people would say yes.
Yeah.
But there are obviously probably millions of diehard Jackson fans who just can't or won't accept it.
Now, and I'm going to say that based on things I've read on Facebook, for example, from Facebook friends of mine who are, as you say, diehard Jackson fans, they're saying, well, why would you believe these boys? Why would you believe this? They've said it didn't happen in the past, and so why are you believing them now?
Yes.
And so I do wonder. I mean, I can see why Reed made this.
Yes.
And I can see he made it very well. And I know that these boys want their story to be heard.
Yes.
But I don't know that it's actually going to convince anybody who's been saying, oh, you know what? Maybe the King of Pop, whose posters are on my walls, maybe he was a pedo after all. I can't see that Damascus Road experience happening, because I think people are so passionate in their love.
I think they are passionate.
Yeah.
The second half of the documentary addresses some of those issues.
Yeah.
I think probably, some, as you say, some will never believe it, but and maybe there's a group somewhere in the middle who are beginning to be swayed a little bit because of the conviction of the accounts,
the
family members around that, and you know we hear his phone messages to these kids, we see the faxes he wrote.
Yeah, it's creepy, isn't
it? You know, it's like a prosecutor in court saying, if you look at one little strand of evidence by itself, maybe it doesn't stand up. You put all those strands together and you get a rope.
Yes.
And that's kind of what you would say about this, perhaps. I found myself believing them. I did believe them.
And I think that's Reed's meticulous documentary making.
Yeah.
So the question that has to be, are we still going to listen to Thriller?
Yeah, that is a good question, isn't it?
I mean, obviously, I took down my Hitler watercolors off the wall before we filmed this. Because seriously, I mean, how do you deal with this?
Isn't that an interesting question? Because we talk about entertainers, don't we?
Yes.
You and I. And right now, you know what? I made a little, a song list for myself from...
Playlist
for myself on Spotify the other day. And I actually, this is a few weeks ago, and I actually put a Michael Jackson song on there.
Ooh, okay.
And
Which one, out of curiosity?
Well, I'm so embarrassed to even say the title.
Oh, no, it's not Ben, is it?
No.
Good, because the front door's right there.
No, it's... Oh, I'm embarrassed to say it. It's The Way You Make Me Feel.
Okay. it's a decent catch.
It's a decent catch, but way you make me feel, you've seen that documentary, you think, oh no, it's
about it's like listening to Rolf Harris sing Two Little Boys, and you're going, the signs were there, weren't they?
Yeah, so I think I probably will struggle to listen to him now. I don't know if that will last forever, I don't know. I think he wrote some great pop songs, you can't deny that, but when you now know what you know, you can't unknow it.
Yes.
And I personally would now struggle to put one of his songs on my playlist.
See, I'm fortunate because I always thought he was overrated. I always thought Thriller's got one or two decent songs on it. He can dance. I mean, I remember watching in the mid-90s a concert video on telly.
Yeah.
And all I could think was, I couldn't hear his voice. He was so down in the mix that, I mean, the audience were whooping and hollering like American audiences are given to every time he did one of those astonishing dance moves.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he could move like nobody's business.
Yeah.
But the singing was... It was as though they were masking it behind his backing vocalists because his singing wasn't there at all.
Right, so that's a convenient out for you, Mr. McKay. Yes. But what if it was
someone I never liked him anyway.
Yeah, but what if it was someone you did like? I mean, there's been lots of other entertainers even caught up in this sort of stuff.
There have, yeah. Well, obviously, I could never listen to my Rolf Harris records any longer.
No, there you are.
I mean, this is nearly a shameful admission. I've always been a big glam rock fan.
Right.
I love my Sweet and my Slade and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But I do feel a little bit squirrely when Gary Glitter comes on.
Because
again, when you hear songs like "Do You Want to Touch Me," because I kind of like to touch you, actually, to be honest.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, this is getting a little bit creepy. Mm. Do I really want to? But then, okay, so obviously paedophilia is off the table, right?
Yes.
We're not tolerating that. But how many other character flaws will we tolerate? I'm a massive Rolling Stones fan.
Right.
Keith Richards is, from what I've read, one of the most reprehensible human beings known to man.
Mm.
I don't think I'd want to sit and have a beer with him.
No.
But I love listening to his
music. So it's that whole issue, how do you separate what the artist does, their art that they put out to the public, with the person that they are?
And also, how bad are they allowed to be? And obviously, like I say, paedophilia, no doubt, no question whatsoever.
Yeah.
But just generally being a shit...
Mm. Well, probably not.
Yeah, exactly. But there is clearly a continuum within there. Yeah. And so, see, I don't know. Like I say, fortunately, I've got the outs. But you said you took The Way You Make Me Feel off your playlist.
I'm not a huge fan of his, but I thought some of his earlier songs were very well used pop songs. And I always thought that was a very catchy song.
It was.
And the other... Just quickly, Steve.
Go on.
This thing about the allure or the lure of... celebrity,
yeah,
and how not just these little boys but their mothers,
the
other family were just consumed by this idea that Michael Jackson was made us a special friend.
I know,
and he's going to look after us, and we're going to look after him. He needs us,
it's Michael,
yeah, it's all that.
Well, I was watching last night,
insidious, it's just so disturbing.
Safechuck's mother was talking about how that we were flying to Europe first class and we were staying in these lovely hotels, and I'm thinking. Yeah, I can see how you would allow yourself to be pulled into that.
Mm.
Now, when you then say, okay, I'm going to go and have your son, your 10-year-old son, sleep in my bedroom with me and you can go and sleep on another floor, I'm thinking that's when you got to say, no, I'm sorry, I draw the line. But I can't imagine having the experience of having been played. Let's be fair about this.
Absolutely played. Groomed and played and trapped and all those sort of words. They were.
He played a long game, didn't he?
Yes. That you're right, and when you see that in this documentary playing out, and there's more than one little boy, maybe there's three or four of who knows, then you even look at it, because all that talk about Jackson just being weird and sick himself,
that's probably true, but
there's more than that. Just that there's a deliberateness to it.
On the one hand, yes, he was a child, never had a childhood, and always tried to regress with a child. On the other hand, there was a profound manipulativeness to the man, and also, even if he was a child at heart who didn't really understand he was doing something wrong, at the very least it was very obvious that he knew that other people thought it was wrong.
Yes.
And when you are a child, when you're 9 years old, you don't understand right and wrong.
No.
But you do understand that mummy and daddy will shout at you.
Yeah.
And he understood that he'd get shouted at.
Yes.
So he can't even claim that he didn't know that that on the level that he operated, it was transgressive.
So
I mean, like I say, he's not here to defend himself.
No.
Or his music, for that matter.
No.
But,
well, it, Yeah, yeah. I think it's a pretty important document, this documentary.
Yeah, it's a really good way of putting it. I like
and,
that, yeah.
There will be varying reactions to it, but yeah. I think it's a good documentary. It is one-sided, but that's what it is. It's telling these guys' story.
Quite unapologetically.
Unapologetically. You can choose not to believe them. I found myself believing them. I thought they were pretty compelling.
Yeah.
And there we have it.
Yes. So you wouldn't call it entertainment, but it's certainly... it's a fascinating look at an entertainer.
It certainly is.
It is. Right. I think...
Should we move on?
Deep breath, Simon. Cleansing breath.
Tea here.
Cleansing breaths. Yes. Right. Actual entertainment.
Yes.
Up to a point.
Yeah.
Up to a point.
Yeah.
Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah.
Been around for decades.
Mm.
No one thought they'd be around this long.
Probably not.
And yet, probably they didn't.
No. But
here they are. And yet here they are, headlining two nights back to back at Spark Arena.
Mm. We both saw the first night.
There, absolutely, and yes.
The fact that it was the first night is very important to what the conversation we're about to have.
Yes. So first of all, let's just go with what we saw.
Yes.
Right? Show starts off with Flea,
mm-hmm.
who is as astonishing a bassist as you could wish to see.
Yeah, I think that's... Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
I mean, the man can slap like nobody. I think, what was the phrase you used in your written review? enough funk that you could dine out on.
Something like that, I said.
Yeah, that was an inspired line.
I said, Flea's power slap on that bass gives you funk to dine out on, and then some.
That'll do quite nice. That's it, yeah.
He was great. I've never seen him. Yeah. This is the first time I'd seen the band live.
Me too.
And I think Flea was kind of the star of the show, actually.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, and he, because the bass is not just being a bass, it's almost driving the melody of a lot of the songs.
It is, yeah. It's
well.
Not just simply hooking into the rhythm section.
Yeah,
is it?
Yeah.
So it's a very prominent instrument. So you got him and Josh, what's his face? Klinghoffer.
Yes.
Come on, doing a jam. Then on comes John Cadis, mm-hmm. and starts doing. John Frusciante was the other guitarist. I'm sorry, you're right. Yeah. Anthony Kiedis comes on.
Yeah.
And they work through. Well, what you expect from a band like that? It's going to be a greatest hits set, right?
Sort of, yes.
So we kind of got a greatest B-side set, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things we struck us, wasn't it, Steve? First, as you say, a lot of pretty big songs weren't there, and I kind of wrote them down because I know there was one song you were particularly interested in was Danny California.
Yeah, what's one of their big recent hits?
Yeah,
it's a fantastic song.
Yep.
Nowhere to be seen.
No. Other Side was a big song.
Yeah.
From the California. Fornication album, yeah. That wasn't there. Around the World wasn't there. And their biggest hit, Under the Bridge, wasn't there.
No!
So that's four pretty big.
And I was gutted because I'd looked at their playlist from the previous show, which was in Perth.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about Around the World, but certainly Danny California was there.
Right.
And Under the Bridge was there. Yeah. And I think Suck My Kiss was on there as well.
Right.
And we got none of those.
No.
Although, to be fair, there wasn't room to fit them in the set list.
Well, that's the other point, because as we were struck by the brevity of the concert.
Yes.
The main set was what, an hour and...
15. Yep.
And then we had maybe 10, 12 minutes after
Two song encore.
Yeah. And so, you've probably seen more concerts than I have. That would be that would be the shortest main set I think I've seen. I'm pretty sure.
The last time I saw a big band do a main set that short would have been U2 around Elland Road in Leeds in 1987.
Okay.
We're going back a bit. It was really, really short. It was surprisingly brief.
So I mean, I think what they did do, I was impressed with. There was a lot of energy and all that. That's good. Later we found, didn't we? And you pointed this out to me that there was a bit of upset near the front that you and I weren't immediately apparent.
There was some weirdness about people who paid $450 for the VIP section at the front, and they were supposed to have had the whole of the front section all to themselves, and they were kept off just to the wings. It's all in the NZ Herald. There was a big article about people complaining about it.
Yes.
So it's oddly. So apparently the production of the show was oddly managed by Spark Arena promoters. We don't know who.
Mm.
The set list was bizarre. And then the following night, the second night, after they'd worn themselves up on us, then all the big hits got trotted out.
Yeah, including a cover of a Split Enz song, which would have been fascinating to hear. Why they couldn't have done that two nights in a row, I don't know.
Well, apparently back in Oz, for example, when they played Melbourne, they did a Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds song.
Ah.
So they clearly know to pander to the local audience.
Yeah, but, so And you know what? There was a point at the end of the concert we saw. The it was kind of a long goodbye, and Chad
it wasn't
Smith,
it just was protracted.
The drummer Chad Smith.
Yes,
he went out on the front and said how great people were, and he was throwing his drumsticks out. It seemed to go on for a long time. And I'm pretty sure the last thing he said was something like, "Hey, if you can, come back tomorrow night."
Because that's where we're playing the good songs.
It was almost like he was apologetic for having shortchanged people.
In hindsight, that's probably what was going on there. So what we saw was good.
Yeah, it was. It was. I did discover that I've only got, I think I shouldn't admit this, I've only got one Peppers album at home, which is Californication.
Yeah.
And I was aware of some of the other big songs. When you see a band live and you see song after song after song, you get a different... If you're not hugely familiar with them, you get this idea of really what they're about.
Yeah.
And that sort of funky song, when you hear it one after the other, I sort of, after a while, I felt, how should I put this? Not totally my cup of tea. That's fine. Yeah. That's not a criticism. It's
but,
just, yeah.
But you were about to say samey, weren't you?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. You could tell when a song started off and Flea was playing a bass line that was immediately recognisable to the crowd, boom, they were into it.
Yeah.
But if it was a song that wasn't quite so big, you weren't quite so sure. So,
exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so I wouldn't say, it wasn't like an awful night out, but it was a surprisingly short and underpowered night out in terms of the songs we wanted to hear.
Underpowered, yes.
Is that a good way of putting it?
That works. That absolutely works, yes. Yeah, so would you go and see him again?
I don't know if I would, actually.
I'd need to see the set list first.
Yeah. Kiedis is an interesting guy. Kiedis, have you say his name?
Anthony.
Anthony. Quite in it. In it, he does his shirt off thing and he's
of course he
muscly and he looks fit and he's...
he's 57.
57. He looks strong. He does his dancing around thing. I found myself not quite sure every now and then how genuine it all was, whether it was just a bit too affected. I just couldn't quite get my handle on that.
When you've been doing it for that long, either A, it's completely and utterly affected and you're going through the motions, or B, the reason you're still doing it is because you love it.
Yeah.
And you couldn't figure out which one it was.
My views varied during the night.
That's interesting.
What about you?
I was more focused on his voice.
Okay.
Because I if you listen to songs like, for example, Give It Away, which they close with, from Blood Sugar Sex Magik, which is a fantastic song, and he's got that wonderful sort of slightly lispy, raspy voice. Or again, if you listen to, say, Danny California, which we didn't get to that night, there's a certain nasal quality to it, which... I mean, you could call it a whine, but that's not fair, because it actually really works.
Yes.
But I wasn't hearing any of that really distinctive character to his voice. People are saying he's a more accomplished singer now, but I think he's lost a lot of the distinctiveness to his voice. And so, to answer your question, if that's indicative, then I'd say possibly he hasn't quite got the edge he used to have, which is a shame.
It is a shame.
Yeah.
So, come back to your question, would I see him a second time? Possibly not. Probably not, I'd say.
The box has been ticked.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I would have liked to have heard a couple of more songs. If I knew they were going to play some of those bigger songs, maybe I would. Maybe.
Yes, I think we'll leave it in the set list first.
Okay. Yeah, so I went this week as well. It's a busy week since we were last on our podcast, weren't we? To see the Canadian gentleman from Vancouver, no less, Brian Adams.
Yes.
And I remember you saying when we talked about this that you'd seen him not that long previous.
Just over a year ago. Yeah. He was at Matakana.
Right.
Yes.
And I decided, I remembered reading your review at the time.
Right,
I won't go back and read it a second time.
I'll just
put that over there and just try and approach this from a freshish sort of perspective.
Makes sense.
But I think that he... And my image going in was a little mixed.
Yeah.
I guess Bryan Adams, I think of the big songs like Run to You and Summer of 69, that raspy rock voice, which I have to say, and I put this in my review on cravepodcast.com, always to me evoked a bit of Springsteen.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
But big voice, solid, no-nonsense, hard-out rocker, but a lot of the songs sort of middling, almost middle of the road, not in a sort of safe-ish sort of rock way.
Yeah, safe is a really good word for it, yeah.
Yeah, so that was my expectations were probably not super high.
Yeah.
And so because of that, and the expectations mean a lot when you, to what sense you get of enjoyment from a concert, of course. Actually ended up enjoying it.
Good enough.
Yeah, because he, first of all, man, can that guy sing?
Oh, there's no denying that.
He can belt out that song.
Yes, he can.
I mean, he's when you see him on stage, he's quite slightly built.
Yeah,
slim, not a big guy, but that voice. I made a point. I thought at times it was almost like a controlled yell.
Mm. Oh, that's well, controlled is good.
Yeah, but he wouldn't keep it up there all the time. He would dip down and do other things with it. Obviously,
give yourself laryngitis.
And he was, the other thing is, you know, let's come back to what you and I were just saying about the Red Hot Chili Peppers and how genuine the front man was. I found myself, you know, trying to assess that. How much was he genuinely into it? These are songs, many of them he's played a lot before. And I found, overall, I liked him. I thought he seemed to care about who he was in front of. He was playing to the audience quite a lot, talking to them quite a lot.
Yeah.
Orchestrating the audience quite well to join in on songs. It was very polished, but I felt I was in front of a genuine guy.
Yeah.
That was the overall, and that really counts for a lot and carries you through the concert.
That's fair, yeah.
But it's not that long ago since you saw him, so what do you sort of, stays with you from him?
My recollection was he was extremely Canadian. He was very, very polite. He was very nice.
Yes.
So when I saw him, for example, he and all his band were all dressed identically. Okay. Jeans, white dress shirts, and then black blazers.
Right.
And the whole thing felt very, very corporate. Now, the songs are good. He's got some great songs. I mean, the ones you mentioned, obviously, are the highlights.
Yeah.
But there was a degree to which, for my money, it was... You said before, safe.
Yes.
That was my overwhelming sensation, was it was extremely safe.
Okay. Well, that's not what you want from a rock concert.
No.
Really?
No, I feel like we're having flashbacks to last week's talk about the Eagles.
Yes.
To a degree. But, I mean, there was a little bit more Joe Walsh and a little bit less Glenn Frey going on.
Yeah.
But still a little bit safe.
Yeah. It's certainly, you mentioned the Canadian thing. He's a vegan. He's obviously got quite a green view of the world. And there was some accompanying video and whatnot, especially in the first part of the concert, which was a bit twee, I thought, and a little bit distracting from what was happening on the stage. But he did do some, I don't know if he did it when you saw him, some sort of solo acoustic stuff.
Don't remember that specifically now.
Yeah, which was a bit more heartfelt and felt a little bit more in the moment.
Right, yeah.
I think that the audience appreciated that. So I think it just took it slightly above the line of just being a feeling that you're in the hands of someone who's done this a million and two times before and they're just going through the motions. It didn't feel like that.
Well, that's good.
And I think he made a point that this was his first ever indoor concert in New Zealand. And that may have helped a sense of being in an enclosed space and kind of sharing more of an intimate moment, perhaps.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, possibly.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the screen backdrop, right? One thing that I do remember from his show in Matakana a year or so ago was when they played Summer of 69.
Yes.
They had the lyrics on projected, or paint, or possibly painted, being projected on a naked woman's body. And I remember talking to a few people who were saying, seriously? Are we still doing this, Brian? Is he still doing it?
Yes.
That does surprise me. One would have thought people had moved on just a little bit.
I guess, well, maybe. I haven't looked to see what he's said, if anything, about that.
Yeah.
But maybe it's sort of trying to evoke a sort of the different mindset of the 60s. I don't know. Maybe.
No, possibly.
But, possibly. I mean, it's not a 2010s sort of way to present something.
Late 2010s in particular. It felt out of place. It felt faintly like we don't do this anymore. We've kind of evolved. So that surprised me.
Anyway, so, okay. Well, anyway, if it's... If you just want a straight out rock concert, you know, you can't go too far wrong with him. I think he can sing.
Well, I mean, I also saw him back in about the late 80s, I think, about 86, 87 in Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
And so, 30 odd years now.
Mm.
And he was pretty good then.
Right.
So you think he's had 30 years now to take what he was good at then.
Yeah.
And he's been rehearsing, let's face it, Summer of 69 and Run to You for 30 years. If you can't play those songs well by now, and clearly it shows he's clearly got this. I mean, he's, you know, we were saying before about the Red Hot Chili Peppers, that you either go through the motions because it's just what you do and you've been doing it for years, or you do it for years because it's what you love.
Yeah. Okay, well...
What sense are you getting?
I got the latter sense from him.
That he's really still enjoying it.
Yeah, and he needed to, because the other thing I must quickly say is, when I heard those songs one after the other, the lyrics, a lot of the lyrics for me were very syrupy and soppy. And I don't know, there's nothing wrong with romantic rock, that's great, but I felt
everything
very corny.
I do it for you. Yeah,
They're very corny. So he had to work hard to overcome that for me.
And this from the man who's got The Way You Make Me Feel on his playlist. Fair enough.
So I
noticed you've commented on in our notes here about, I think the phrase is hardworking earnest rocker.
Yes.
And that's probably about the strength of it, really.
Yeah. With a bit of a Canadian sort of feel good thing vibe happening there.
Yes.
Now, look, to move on, I've actually got a confession to make to you.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
As you know...
Tell me, my child.
I generally have been a bit of a fan of the Marvel Studios output.
Yes, you have. You've definitely been our...
Our
standard...
But I think I've got early onset of a new syndrome.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Go on,
tell me. It's called superhero overload disorder.
Oh, mate, that's the...
Sod.
Yes, I've got an acute case of that. However, tell me what caused it in you.
So I went on to see Captain Marvel. This is the latest in the Marvel Studios juggernaut of films they've been churning out. And I came away thinking, it's not bad.
Yep.
It's well put together. They've got some good actors. Brie Larson, an Oscar winner.
Yep.
Samuel L. Jackson. And those two sparked off together very well, I thought.
Oh, yeah.
That was the highlight of the film for me. Usual high standard of special effects, the Marvel mix of humor with action, all that. So it's not a bad film. It's quite entertaining, but it just felt a bit flat to me. And I boiled it down to two things. There just have been so many of these films, and there is a pattern to them. They try and change it up a bit, but inevitably there's a pattern there.
There's the overload you're talking about.
So I've got a second reason, but I'll just pause because I want to let you nip in and tell me what you thought, because you're not such a fan.
And oddly enough, I think this is probably the best one I've seen in quite a while.
There you go.
Because for a lot of it, it wasn't a superhero film.
Yeah.
So it starts, if you remember, it starts off on the Kree homeworld.
Yes.
Hella.
Mm.
It's a hella good place.
Yeah.
And you've got no idea what's the deal with Brie Larson's character Veers, and then Jude Law's character, whose name I can't even remember, but these are two actors I've got a lot of time for. Jude Law, I can watch in anything. I think he's brilliant.
Right.
Brie Larson, I have seen her in a few things now.
Yeah.
I mean, first time I saw her, I think she was in Community, which is a very bizarre American sitcom, and she was good in that.
Yeah.
She was obviously outstanding in Room.
Yes.
And I was fascinated to see how she'd be in this, because like Room sets her up as being a really good, solid acting talent. Community showed that she could do comedy as well.
Yes.
And so you expect a little bit of levity. You know, it's not going to be a laugh-out-loud comedy.
No.
But you do expect levity.
You do.
And lightness in these films. And I thought she did that fantastically.
I agree.
She can smirk like nobody's business.
Yeah.
She's like a very, very slight twinkle in her eye. That lets you know, like, she's not taking any of these people seriously.
Yes.
And I loved that.
Yep,
She was fantastic. She's great with Jude Law.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not often that Jude Law is not the most sparky actor in the film. But then he's not off up against Samuel L. Jackson.
No.
Who, to begin with, I thought was being a little bit weak. But then once the those two started to mesh, it was amazing. Because that's when it got good. When suddenly she comes to Earth.
Yes.
About 15 minutes in.
Yeah, yeah.
And it shifts gears. It stops being superheroes and space action and special effects, which was rubbish. And I couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. It made no sense at all. As they often don't. It's just,
yeah, yeah.
Because you're trying to like create context and build up a schema of what you're seeing, and it all gets bewildering. Suddenly she's on Earth, and you got her, and you got Jackson, and you're thinking, oh,
yeah,
I think I like this.
Yeah, that was good, and especially good because in this film is set in the past,
about 10-15 years ago.
So
yes.
We see a younger, digitally enhanced younger Samuel L. Jackson as this character called Nick Fury.
No, just Fury.
Oh, sorry, yeah, Fury. Quite right. So in the other films, he's older and he's a bit more hard-bitten and he's a bit more serious.
He's a bit more Samuel L. Jackson,
basically. Yeah, but here he's a bit lighter, he's a bit more at ease, and he's a bit more jokey. And I saw that interplay with Brie Larson. I enjoyed that. As I say, that was, to me, probably the thing I enjoyed the most of the film.
Those two were fantastic.
Very, very good.
Yeah. And then eventually, obviously, it had to go back to bring the Kree in, and you had to have the big battle fight. You know, and superhero fights bore me senseless.
I made a note to myself to say that if there's nothing, if it's just a fight for a fight's sake, I agree. We've seen them umpteen times. Unless there's a particular plot turn that hinges on this fight, then you're right. Yeah. I agree.
You know the good guy's going to win.
Yeah.
And the good guy in this case is Captain Marvel, who doesn't get named such until the end. You know, it's Veers or Carol.
Carol, that's
right. You know that the Brie Larson's character is going to win when she has the big fight.
Yep.
But you just sit there waiting for it to end because you know eventually it is going to end. And you just feel like, okay, go on, have your fight, let us know when it's finished, and I'll put my phone away and wake up.
Yeah.
And that, suddenly, that was pants for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Didn't like that.
Okay. We should mention that this was the film, at long last, after more than a decade of turning out these films, where Marvel puts a female as the central hero in the story.
Central hero, central hero's best mate.
Yeah.
Central hero's backstory character.
Yes, and in the best mate's daughter, who's also quite significant. Daughter
is always going to be female, to be fair.
You're right. I'm glad you pointed that out to me.
But seriously, I mean, it smashed through the Bechdel test. There was no doubt. These are women who are just simply getting on with being characters in a film that's about them and around them.
Yeah.
And for a while, the blokes just become peripheral.
Yeah.
Why the hell not?
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. And not even women, black women.
Yeah.
With possibly even a suggestion that there could have been a romantic interest between them. A hint, possibly. It's one possible reading of it.
Yeah.
But they didn't have to flog it.
No, they didn't.
They just got on with doing it. It was really, really well done.
One of the things that about it, Steve, I always thought Superman was the most boring superhero because he could do anything and no one could hurt him.
Yes.
You know, he was just like a goody-good.
And
I thought, I thought Captain Marvel's powers started to go down that line. Seemed like she was invincible, it looked like.
Yeah.
And that gets a bit boring after
especially
a while.
Especially when they do the big superhero fight at the end.
Yeah,
Because like I say, you go through the motions. But did you pick up the Easter eggs? The sort of the little callbacks to other films?
Probably not. Tell me.
Well, there's one prominent character is a cat.
Yes, that's right.
And the cat's name was?
I've forgotten.
Goose.
Goose. Now, Goose was in Top Gun?
Goose was Maverick's wingman in Top Gun.
Right.
Did you notice the bit where at one point I can't believe we're actually going to praise an Australian here, but we have to do it.
Go on.
Ben Mendelsohn.
Yeah.
Is it Talos?
Yeah, he's a Skrull.
Yes, and he was brilliant.
He was good.
I really liked him a lot. But there's one moment where he's staring at Samuel L. Jackson, staring at Fury, and he's got the paper cup in his hand and he's got the straw and he's taking a big slurp out of it. And
that's... yeah, I know that's the scene from Quentin Tarantino's
Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction.
Yes. Where any second now he's about to do his line, he goes, "I will strike you down with furious anger." And there's a few of those lovely little callbacks.
Yeah, okay. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's Samuel L. Jackson who gets as far as mother.
Yeah.
And you think, okay, this is Jackson just reverting the type, fair enough.
Yeah.
But there's a few lovely little callbacks.
Yeah. Okay, now, and there's, just quickly, the main reason why I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I might.
There's more.
Is it's a distraction
yeah.
from the big, big story that's going on in this Marvel Cinematic Universe verse about the threat from this Thanos guy who was in the Avengers Infinity War.
Oh.
I say that because that story...
Because we have to go back to that, don't
we? Well, yeah, because that story has been taken 10 years to build up, right? They get to the end of Avengers Infinity War. It looks like Thanos has won, or mostly won.
Yeah.
Nick Fury is about to die. He sends out this message for help to Captain Marvel.
Right.
So we have to say, before they get to the next film, we have to know who is this person, so they have to do a separate movie.
Yes.
But if you are a fan of this genre and of these characters, and you've been waiting for this Thanos saga to play out, it's like being put on pause.
Yeah.
Like for me. And I knew that at the end of these Marvel movies, always at the very, very end, in the credits sequence at the end, they'll give you a snippet of what's coming up next. And I found myself waiting so much for that to see the tie-in for the rest of the overarching
story.
Which, to be fair,
you did get, didn't you?
You did? Oh, I got it. Yeah. I got it. But it just felt we were treading water when I wanted to swim a lot more quickly.
Yes.
And it nagged at me.
Yeah.
But as I said in my review on the website, I don't think Marvel had any choice. Because she's so powerful, if they'd introduced her before now, well, she could have taken on this Thanos guy. What, you know, that would have raised that question. But if they waited until the next film, then they would have to shoehorn her origin into the story.
But in a previous film called Avengers Assemble, it should really have been called Most Avengers Assemble.
That's right. Anyway.
So
it's not a bad film at all. I think it's done very, very well at the box office. I'm sure it'll make hundreds of millions of dollars, as they will have.
And Brie Larson.
And she is very good, and Jackson's very good. But if you've been looking, take a step back from this movie at the big, big picture of what's going on, I just found that a little bit frustrating.
I'm with you on that one. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, personally, I think they're all a pile of nonsense anyway. But this was the best pile of nonsense so far. So I think we've worked through the entire script there, haven't we?
So we had a busy old time the last couple of weeks. Is there much coming up soon that we need to just keep an eye out?
Well, there's one big musical announcement. Let me call it up. Let me get the information to hand. No, there's not that. I was watching The Daily Show earlier. as you do.
Yes.
As you do. No, the big announcement is going to be Metallica.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're still alive.
Yeah,
well, I didn't expect that, did you?
No.
Yeah, they're coming back to New Zealand in 2019. If you remember last year or last summer, there was only one really big stadium show last summer.
Mm.
It was Taylor Swift in November. Nobody else played Mount Smart.
When did Paul McCartney play?
Previous year.
Oh, previous year. Okay.
Yeah, he was part of a season that had, who else? Foo Fighters were there. Sheeran did three nights.
Yes.
Sia was there. There was quite a few playing Mount Smart last season. But this season, we only had Taylor Swift.
Right.
But this is the first of this coming summer, and they're kicking off early, 31st of October. It's a Thursday, it's a school night.
There's actually a Metallica link to Bryan Adams' show this week.
Really?
Because one of the covers he played right at the end, which is on this new album he's put out, is he said it's actually an Irish folk song that goes back hundreds of years, but he said it mentioned other bands which have played it, including Metallica, Whiskey in the Jar.
Oh, wow, that's a double this song as well. That's the version I know. Possibly Thin Lizzy as well.
Thin Lizzy did it as well. So he does it as an acoustic version. Ryan Adams does, and I can't remember their version, Metallica's version.
I can't imagine the acoustic version. Oh, that's brilliant.
Anyway, they know how to play rock.
Oh, don't they just? Yes. So they're going to be at Mount Smart Stadium on the 31st.
Yeah.
Their opening act is Slipknot.
Okay, who I've heard of, but I don't know. Yeah. I'm not much of their material.
No, I don't like their music, I'll be honest. It's too intense, too heavy, too thrashy for my tastes.
Okay.
But I shot them a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm. Did they survive?
Well, I survived, and that was a miracle. And I did photography at their show in Auckland about 18 months ago. And what I did come away with thinking was, well, the music's poo, but they do know how to put on a stage show.
Right,
they're an amazing, amazing performers. Yeah. So they've packed out Spark Arena, and they're the support act.
Right.
Metallica. So that's that impresses, doesn't it? Now, here's something else that's worth mentioning about this. Now, obviously, they're playing the West Island as well.
Are they?
Several dates.
Very good.
And so the tour is being called the Worldwide Tour, and they're selling what they're calling the Wherever I May Roam Black Ticket.
Oh.
And it says one ticket allowing floor access to any Metallica show on this run. Black ticket holders need only choose the show or shows and make an online reservation no less than 48 hours before the gig.
Hmm.
And those tickets are going for $600.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean, it sounds like a great idea, except that it means you can go to Perth, Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, and Auckland. So you're paying $600 for your black ticket.
Yes.
How much are you paying for your airfares?
Airfares.
That's the downside to it. But on the face of it, it does sound like an awfully good deal, doesn't
it? Yeah, fair enough.
So that's the big music announcement for this
Lovely.
Week.
All right. So look, if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at crave podcast.
Okay.
Did I just say?
The same thing you've been saying at the end of the last 78 episodes.
podcast@cravepodcast.com.
That's the one. Okay. Yes. And if, like Simon, you find that too complicated to remember, at Crave Podcast, we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook.
Yes. We are indeed. So, good chat this week. Thank
Not
you very much.
Bad.
Yeah. So, I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Certainly is. That went well.
Certainly did.
Yeah.